From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. About a year and a half ago, a health reporter at the Washington Post named Lenny Bernstein started reporting on the huge number of Americans dying of drug overdoses. His editor had a pretty simple question about how it all started with prescription painkillers.
She came to me and she said, "What I'd like you to do is to explain to people how all those pills got on the street. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Either somebody put them out there or somebody let them go out there." So it was a great question.
Lenny started digging. He didn't know it then, but the story was going to lead him into the halls of power.
To the Justice Department, to Capitol Hill, to the White House, to the drug industry.
The Washington Post assembled a reporting team around the project, including investigative reporter Scott Higham.
Well, I've been a reporter for about 30 years, and it's the swampiest thing I think I've ever seen in Washington.
What they found raises serious questions about our federal government's role in the opioid epidemic, and it takes us deep inside the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA. Later in the show, which we first aired last year, we're going to hear a very intimate story of one family in the aftermath of an overdose death. But first, we're teaming up with the Washington Post in 60 Minutes to answer the question, why was America flooded with pain pills in the first place? Reveal's Laura Starcheski takes it from here.
When Lenny's editor first gave him this assignment, he started cold calling a ton of people. He was trying to find out, why didn't someone stop the flow of pills?
Finally, someone said to me, you know, you ought to talk to Joe Ranazzisi. This is what he did until he retired recently.
Joe Ranazzisi had just retired from a position high up in the DEA.
So I called him, and I just lucked out because I caught him at the right time. He had just been pushed out of a job he loved, and that a job where he felt he was making a real difference, really doing something about the deaths that we were seeing on the street. And he was just, you know, explosive. The conversation was explosive. I mean, I couldn't get him off the phone.
Joe wanted Lenny to know about these companies that he said were largely responsible for the opioid epidemic. Not pharmaceutical manufacturers, companies called distributors who actually ship the drugs.
The three big ones are McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, and Cardinal. They control pretty much the whole market.
These distributors make billions every year. They are some of the largest American companies of any kind. But Lenny, a health reporter, knew almost nothing about them.
So Joe was kind of schooling me on this. And he was saying, you know, they are responsible. There are hundreds of millions of opioids on the streets killing people right now that don't need to be there.
I went to the D.C. suburbs to meet Joe Ranazzisi. He came to the door of his townhouse wearing jeans and comfortable shoes. He's got close-cut salt-and-pepper hair and a hound dog named Banjo who wants to jump all over me.
Banjo! No! No jumping!
Joe's got a basement full of paperwork and guitars he keeps meaning to play more.
Too many guitars and not enough time to play guitar, so...
Did you play in a band?
On and off.
I can't really imagine Joe on a stage. He gives off a no-nonsense, street-smart vibe like a seasoned beat cop. He started as a DEA street agent in the 1980s, mostly in Detroit, chasing down dealers.
You could be coming into work in Detroit in the morning and end up in Albuquerque, New Mexico in the afternoon.
He worked on all kinds of cases.
Coke, heroin, weed, club drugs, the party drugs.
He did undercover buys.
It's pretty simple, actually. It's how convincing you are.
And he loved it. Best job he could imagine.
Protecting people. That's what's important. I wanted to make sure that, you know, I did my part.
Along the way, he worked cases where prescription drugs were sold on the street, and he perfected his training so he could go after bigger and bigger fish. Joe has a law degree and a pharmacy degree. In 2006, Joe was promoted to a new position in D.C. at DEA headquarters. He'd be in charge of a special unit called Diversion Control. Not as glamorous as busting heroin rings and making headlines. In fact, it was kind of a DEA backwater.
It was a small unit. that did a lot with very little.
Their mission was to keep prescription drugs from ending up in the hands of drug users and dealers. This was just as the opioid epidemic was getting out of control.
Millions and millions and millions of tablets were leaving the pharmacies and going into the communities, and people were overdosing, and it was just a nightmare.
More than 10,000 people would die of prescription drug overdoses that year. So Joe went after the bad doctors. He went after the bad pharmacies. But then he noticed something.
We were noticing that the distributors were sending these huge amounts of drugs into these pharmacies without looking at them, without doing any due diligence, without filing suspicious order reports.
Suspicious order reports. The companies were legally required to report any oddly huge orders to the DEA, but some companies weren't reporting them.
And since they were doing all that, at that point in time, we decided that, you know, we need to take a top-down approach.
Joe decided to go after the distributors sending those truckloads of drugs around the country.
So we're standing in front of a very large Cardinal Health Distribution Center here in Baltimore.
Lenny and I visited this big beige building on the edge of the city to see the distributors in action. Shipping and receiving is behind a big security gate. Trucks are pulling in and out.
These distributors, the wholesale distributors, get the drugs from the manufacturers, the opioids, and they ship them out to the places where you and I consume them. We buy them.
These are high-tech warehouses with sophisticated tracking systems. Cardinal ships all kinds of medicine to hospitals and pharmacies across the country. But not all the pain pills go to people who really need them. The size of the opioid shipments coming out of warehouses like this tells the whole story.
Just to give you a sense of the scale here, between 2007 and 2012, distributors shipped 9 million hydrocodone pills to a pharmacy, a single pharmacy in Kermit, West Virginia, which is a town of 392 people.
Nine million hydrocodone pills for a town of 392 people. If all those pills were really for the people of Kermit, West Virginia, each man, woman, and child would have to take at least 12 pills a day, every day, for those 5 years. At the DEA, Joe had a tool he could use to stop trucks from even leaving the warehouse in a situation like that, an immediate suspension order.
Just think of it this way. An immediate suspension order says, I'm coming into your facility and I'm stopping you from dispensing, distributing, doing anything with controlled substances until we all could figure out what's going on, and we're going to do that before a judge. I don't have to wait a year for a criminal case to go through or for a civil action to go through. I could stop it now.
Joe put the companies on notice. They would be held responsible if pills they shipped ended up on the street. If they didn't follow the law, he'd get an immediate suspension order and stop their shipments. After that, sometimes the company would get slapped with a multi-million dollar fine, which sounds like a lot, but these are Fortune 500 companies.
It just seemed like no one in the industry cared. It's almost like they did a cost-benefit analysis and they said, well, if I can make, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars doing this, and I'm only going to be fined $30, $50, $100 million, then what the heck? I mean, we're making all this money, so why don't we just continue? It was mind-blowing.
By 2010, as the opioid epidemic starts to explode, Joe's small legal team is humming. That year, they filed 52 of those immediate suspension orders against doctors, pharmacies, and distributors.
It was really a glorious time because they were just knocking them dead. They were just, like, filing and filing.
Hearing this, I was wondering, how could these distributors just keep on shipping pills? How did they justify it? I asked Lenny.
Have you ever heard, like, a direct explanation from the companies why they weren't reporting the red flags or taking this on in a systematic way?
I've read many explanations because as they would fight these things out in court, they would give their side. So there are volumes in these court cases of the companies saying, well, we have all these sophisticated analytics that look at these drug flow, and we are super cautious about it, and we don't send anything out where we think there's any kind of a problem. And, you know, how can you expect us to know what's going on in 55,000 drugstores that we supply? Some of them are 3,000 miles away, and you're expecting us to know that there's suspicious ordering going on in some little mom-and-pop drugstore in West Virginia, and we try our best.
I asked the Distributors Association, the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, for an interview, but they wouldn't do one. In a statement they put on their website, they say that they never got enough guidance from the DEA about how to follow the law. They sent emails to the Washington Post saying that the epidemic is not their fault, that overprescribing by doctors is the real problem. Joe's team was going after doctors, and pharmacies too, but by 2012, he had his sights set on the biggest distributors. His team found that a Cardinal warehouse was shipping huge orders of oxycodone to four pharmacies in Sanford, Florida. Again, Lenny Bernstein.
The Cardinal case, you know, the average drugstore in the area of Florida that the DEA focused on would hand out like 65,000 doses of oxycodone a year in 2012. And then the ones that they went in and busted, they were doing 2 million. Well, what's going on there?
The pharmacist would fill prescriptions for oxycodone even if a customer used street slang by asking for the M's or the blues. Sanford, Florida attracted dealers from as far away as Kentucky.
So if you had a 30 milligram oxycodone, you might be able to sell that on the street for $30. So obviously if you had 30 of those, they're worth $900. If you have 300 of those, you know, it's worth $9,000. So that's a lot of money.
This black market gave new meaning to the term drugstore.
It's just what you would think. There's a drugstore, and then there's a line out the door. It fills the lobby. I mean, think of the last time you went to the drugstore. Right? Was there a line out the door into the parking lot going all the way? No. And there's a parking lot filled with out-of-state tags, and there might be a drug dealer, too, in the parking lot, somebody selling to somebody else. And then, like, there would be these signs. You know, it would say something like, you know, cash only, Oxy's 30.
All you had to do was go there and look at the place. Now, Cardinals should have seen that, and I believe they did.
Joe believed they knew because he'd already done one case against Cardinal back in 2007. They'd paid a fine, $34 million, and they'd promised to do better monitoring shipments.
This time was more important because they were doing the same things they did the previous time. And this is the time where we said, look, we gave you your chance. You paid a minor fine. Now we're going to hammer you, which is what we should be doing. That's what regulators do.
Joe's preparing his case. This is in the beginning of 2012. He's confident. He's never lost any of the cases he's brought against distributors so far. Then he gets summoned to a meeting at the Department of Justice.
The meeting will be a signal. Things are about to change.
Cases would just sit and languish for weeks, for months, for a year.
The industry pushes back. That's ahead on Reveal.